Ever feel like there's a better way to build? So do we. I'm Matt, and welcome to the Mindful Builder podcast, where we believe in education through storytelling. Join me and my co-host Hamish as we both have a passion for building better, breaking barriers, and sharing our experience within the building industry. We're not pretending to know it all. In fact, we're learning right alongside you. Join us each week as we tackle complex topics like building science and mental well-being, inviting the brightest minds to connect curiosity with expertise. We want this to be a real conversation, encouraging vulnerability through honest discussions. So if you love this podcast and you're ready to join in, learn and build better, please do us a favor and subscribe wherever listening. It's the best way to make sure you never miss an episode, plus it really helps us out. And if you're feeling extra generous, a 5-star rating and a quick review would be amazing. Your support helps us reach new listeners and even better, allows us to book incredible guests for the future episodes. Thank you so much for being part of our community. We truly appreciate you. And now on to this week's episode.
Hey Sal, do you want to give the audience a little bit of a background about who you are?
As to where to start, I feel like I could be quite broad with my response, but my name is Sal. I'm a qualified carpenter. I'm creating quite a unique pathway with my career as a carpenter. Not the most sort of traditional in terms of, you know, working 6 days a week or anything. But yeah, I guess my background's been in elite sport, and I transitioned into construction in my late 20s. And yeah, it's been a pretty colorful ride.
You're the first guest that has an Wikipedia account, I think.
Which is continually changing. I feel like there's a handful of my friends that continue to try and edit my Wikipedia.
Yeah, I'm adding in now. I was recently interviewed on the Mindful Builder podcast.
Yes, you can absolutely do that, and that's truth. So, yeah, make it work.
Go back to the elite sports person space, because it is pretty impressive.
Well, I grew up in the lovely town of Wagga Wagga, and from the age of 6, I played every single sport I possibly could, and my brothers were a huge influence in regards to what I chose to do as a small kid. And I guess if we weren't playing AFL, we weren't playing soccer, we weren't playing cricket, basketball, we were, you know, running in our backyard and probably playing a variation of all of those sports in one. Having access to so many sports as a kid was a pretty special way to grow up. And I belong to a very supportive family, and my folks were willing to drive myself and my brothers around on weekends and through the week to whatever commitments we had. So it was a pretty big amount of support that my family showed, and I've always been incredibly humbled by that. I was at the age of 12 when I first watched the Matildas play at the Sydney 2000 Olympic Games, and I was utterly obsessed by not only sport but by this game of football. And all I wanted to do was, you know, figure out how I could develop into the best player I could. So from the age of 12, I started setting myself some serious goals, asking myself some big questions as to what I needed to do to develop. And yeah, my career really kind of took off quite quickly. I moved to Sydney at the age of 15, and my parents made a really big decision to live separately, which, you know, in hindsight was a massive decision. And at the time, I was obviously very grateful and thankful that my folks had made that commitment, but it also left a big impact on my brothers in that they didn't have mum around for a solid year or so. But without having made that decision, that choice at that time, I certainly wouldn't have made my debut for the Matildas at 16. So it was an incredibly quick rise. But as a 16-year-old kid, I felt like I was in the exact position that I deserved to be in. I guess there was belief and consistency and hard work in you know, what I was sort of how I was committing to the sport, and yeah, certainly a bit of luck as well, but there's always a little bit of luck.
And you played in 2 Women's World Cups. That's pretty fucking cool.
Yeah, 2 Women's World Cups, and made my debut the same year at 16. I attended the Athens Olympic Games, which was pretty wild as a 16-year-old kid. The Olympics are a tremendous, like, worldwide event where athletes from all over the world are competing, and you know, it's not just about winning. I guess it's about showing the world what you've had, what you've worked so hard to be and to achieve. And yeah, I think joining the Matildas team at the age of 16, I inherited a bunch of older sisters, and that was pretty special in and of itself.
You then travelled to Europe to play. Was it soccer or football? What are we referring it to?
So, yeah, it's kind of interesting. I tend to say soccer just so people don't get confused in Australia. But, yeah, I've definitely grown accustomed to calling it football. So we can go with football for the rest of the pod if you'd like to.
I'm going to lose either way here. If I call it soccer, someone's going to get angry. If I call it football, someone's going to get angry.
Yeah, there's always someone. But
going to a World Cup, that's a huge achievement. What's going through your head when you're going over there? Like, was it a whole new, like, because you've been to two, and you went, was it the first one? I just was sort of, where was it in? I saw the second one was it in Germany? Is that right?
Yeah, the second one was in Germany, and the first one was in 2007 in China.
In China, okay. And so when you go from your first one, I'm assuming that you're very, I'm imagining the emotions are very different. Like, it's a bit of a wow factor, like, where am I? And the second one probably is a bit more like, okay, I've been here before, a bit more experienced. Do you want to talk about the difference between those two?
Yeah, I mean, like, certainly as your career progresses, you know, when you're applying yourself to any kind of pursuit through the years, you're going to gain more experience and in my case, more composure and more skill and more know-how. But in some ways, I feel like the longer my career progressed, the more sort of pressure I was under, the higher that, you know, the expectation. And in some ways, I really was able to handle that. And in others, I kind of feel like, you know, perhaps I did let the pressure get to me at times. You know, whilst perhaps on the outside I was considered this really calm defensive midfielder who could really sort of control the play and move the ball around and, you know, from left to right and really kind of anticipate certain parts of a game. On the inside, I kind of felt a little bit flappier than what people perceived. And part of my career, I guess, you know, I was injured at the age of 26 and had to retire much earlier than what I'd hoped. And I wasn't able to leverage or explore that sort of like mental side of the game, which in some ways would be my only curiosity left when I reflect back on my football career, to have really sort of overcome that. I think, Matt, as you sort of said, like, yeah, I went to Germany for club football towards the end of my career. And when I was fully able to be absorbed by sport, where I didn't have to work, I didn't have to study on the side, I was able to earn a full-time income just from football. That's when I was really able to start honing in on the mental side of my game. So in some ways, it's kind of unfortunate to look back on, but I really do think I was hitting my straps towards the end of my career, which would have been, you know, a couple of years then after those World Cups.
You're probably, what, 5 years, in a sense, too early before it, like, really blew up in Australia? Like, is that, like, am I fair to say that? Like, you sort of created the pathway for females coming into sport now. And I'm looking at some of those people on that team that you played with. Sam Kerr started on the bench in one of those World Cups, and all of a sudden, I think every household in Australia knows who Sam Kerr is.
Yes, and I'm so incredibly proud of that cohort of athletes. You know, I was in my early 20s when the likes of Sammy Kerr, M. Van Egmond, Mackenzie Arnold, Alana Kennedy were all knocking on the door, if not had their foot in the door, with the national team. And, you know, they were a bunch of kids who, you know, really banded together. And if anything, they were a bit bratty and, you know, 16-year-old kids, which is what you want. You know, they've been thrust into this elite environment and they're still, you know, really just hitting their teenage years. Yeah. So I really loved taking them in underneath my wing and being like, yeah, you guys can be your age. But, like, hey, when we turn up to play football, we play football. And yeah, I guess, like, when I think of the stages of my career, there's that 2010 Asian Cup, which we won. And Sammy Kerr was involved in that side at the age of 16, you know, and at that time, that was a dream for the Matildas team, you know, to be winning matches. And then all of a sudden we've got this Asian Cup on the horizon and we make the final against North Korea and it goes to penalties and, you know, we manage to win this thing. And I'm still in touch with Sammy quite a lot. I love to send her little messages every now and again, and I'm incredibly proud of her as to how humbled she's remained through her career. And she has a new goal now, a new dream with the Matildas next year to win the Asian Cup in Australia. And I think that's kind of special to think that, you know, she was a 16-year-old kid achieving a dream she never knew she had up until now, you know, with her new dream with the Matildas next year. So that's kind of special to be a part of that too.
I recall a social media exchange that you and I had probably a couple of months ago when I said, oh, I'd love to get you on the podcast. And I think you responded, I don't know if I have anything to offer your viewers. I have been sitting here for the past 15 minutes, not saying much, just listening to this incredible story from a little girl from Wagga at the age of six, playing lots of sports, 12 years old, going, you know, really realizing that she wanted to play soccer, football, moved to Sydney, kicking her brother's ass in anything that she's, you know, applies herself to. And then at the age of 16, makes the Australian football and soccer team. We haven't even got into the rest of your story yet, and this is pretty incredible. So just reflecting on all of that for a second, like, how proud are you of yourself with that chapter of your life?
I can definitely say that I'm proud, and, you know, quite quickly followed by, without the support of my family or broader Wagga football community, I definitely wouldn't have been in the position that I was. Nor in the position that I'm currently in. I think to start a life being convinced by, you know, a passion, finding something I loved from a very young age, set me up with some big challenges. You know, I've learned some really big lessons. I learned about discipline and resilience at a very young age, all because of this passion that I held. And yeah, those sort of lessons, I guess, have certainly translated into my adult life. Yeah, so it's I am proud. Yeah.
So you said you had an injury at 26. Was that a knee?
So I have. I mean, my biomechanics aren't awesome. I have knocked knees, which means that the meniscal part of my knees are under a lot of pressure. And up until I was sort of 25, 26, I hadn't had much of an issue. But I just based my knees started getting really, really sore, and they would start to swell when I was playing, and it was pretty much just wear and tear. And when I was 25, they went in for like a clean out. There's a cohort of athletes in any sport. We belong to a certain era where the medical teams were under the impression that clean outs were what was best. And we've all heard of the word clean outs in varying sports. So they go in and essentially like clean up any kind of meniscal tear and any kind of any floaty bits and pieces. And then the athlete is able to get back to that sport quicker and pain-free. But the long-term implications of those, you know, lackadaisy kind of clean outs is that there's trauma to the joints. And it's kind of interesting and fascinating in a sense from a human's perspective. So whilst I was back earlier as a footballer, the long-term implications of that, I've now sort of got an osteoarthritis thing happening in both of my knees. Like, there would be a lot of athletes in my position. And I think in this day and age, they really try and rehab the athletes for much, much longer and choose alternate pathways than sort of like, you know, the old clean out.
Is it, it seemed like a bit of a small price to pay, but a big price to pay. Like, it's sort of like this win-win, lose-lose situation with that. Would you, I've always wondered, because you speak to like the older, like Australian football O's, I know their bodies are banged up in there, a few head knocks, and they'd be like, I'd do it again. Would you go through the same process again?
Yeah, I would. And I'm very grateful to be still in a body that is very able. The pain day in, day out is tricky, and having chosen carpentry probably hasn't been the
this most is where I was actually going to transition into that question, because I was going to be like, well, now that you're a carpenter, how does that affect you? Because it's a physical job.
Very. It is a very physical job. So upon retiring, and this is, I guess this is kind of fast forwarding things a little bit, but my right knee in particular, I haven't, for example, this last week, I've been doing something very unrelated to carpentry and my body feels really good right now. My right knee is still a little bit niggly, but that's just the kind of bone on bone. That's just part and parcel of my life now. But yeah, carpentry, I guess, was an interesting decision. But in a sense, everything's quite controlled. It's not incredible. It's not too dynamic. I can anticipate what movement is expected. So whilst it still relies on a lot of strength and agility, it's not so much this kind of like dynamic movement that is like quickly changing directions and whatnot. So that's probably how I've managed my carpentry load to date.
What got you interested in carpentry? And, you know, how long ago?
I started my apprenticeship when I was 28 and I'm now 38. After I finished playing football, I was pretty lost for a couple of years. As is anyone's experience, of which I've realized in the many conversations I've had since in and around retirement. I feel like no matter the context and pursuit, a lot of people experience the whole like identity shift and like, what do I do? And when you've immersed yourself in something for a certain period of time, you're just bound to have that moment of like, what now? There were several years after my career as a footballer that I tried to work in media. I tried some commentary stuff. I worked at Football Australia for a bit in the community space. And I think part of me felt pressure to give back to the sport because it had like given me so much over my lifetime. I remember hopping in the car after a commentary gig and I was asked by my partner at the time like how I felt. And I felt kind of empty. Like it just didn't fill me up in a way that I was sort of expecting it to. Whilst I loved playing football, I have no interest in critiquing it or pulling it apart or why a player made a certain decision. So that was kind of feedback for me where I'm like, okay, I think I need to be open to falling in love with something else other than sport. So by this stage, I was living in the Northern Beaches with my auntie in Avalon, and she was just kind of helping me get back on my feet. And I was eyeing off being a celebrant, and I'm kind of like, oh, that could be fun in anticipation of marriage equality. And I quite enjoying holding space, and I really enjoy love stories. So I'd sort of parked that a little bit in the side of my mind. And then I literally just stumbled across this opportunity to help labor with a builder in the Northern Beaches. And he was in his early to late 30s. It was just a one-person show for him, and he was literally just after employing his first apprentice. He would contract out to a bigger mob, but it would essentially be me and him on our little projects, and then we'd tune in with the bigger guy that he kind of like answered to if he didn't have any work himself. So I hung out with him for 6 weeks, and at the end of 6 weeks, he's like, what about it? Do you want to start an apprenticeship? And by that stage, I was pretty hooked.
I get the sense that your personality would really take very quickly to the physicality of a job like carpentry and actually doing things, completing a task and then seeing the result. Like there's that kind of nice sort of feedback loop, which I know personally what got me hooked. And I'm actually super impressed with, you know, the young guy that took you on in that time, because like fast forward to today and it is becoming so normal to see more women in trade, which is incredible. But back then, you know, 10 years ago, like if I think back, that's just wasn't a thing. How did the industry respond to seeing you on a building site?
Yeah, I mean, like, I guess that was even accentuated by the fact that I was in the Northern Beaches of Sydney, which isn't super progressive in many ways. But with Todd taking me on, I feel like every boss that I've had, and I've had three bosses in the construction industry, they've all had young girls. And immediately I feel like they're open to employing women because perhaps they want their young kids to see what's possible in a sense. Whilst none of them have admitted to that, that's definitely been the continued thread through my employment.
It's a good hypothesis, actually.
Thank you.
Fast forward to now, and I would say that I am getting, I am a sample size of one business. I'm probably getting more young women reach out to me for apprenticeships than I am young men.
Can I actually jump in and ask a question to you, Haim, quickly while you say that? Because we both now have daughters, and I know that Sal's previous employees have never said that. Do you feel there's something about you now that, because you've got a daughter, that you're even more inclined to do it? Because I'll be honest, I think I am.
Jim, that's an interesting thought, because if you had have asked me that 10 years ago, I probably would have said yes. But now when I think about it, and I'm saying this, you know, with a huge amount of sincerity, my expectation for any of my kids is that they could do whatever they want, regardless of gender. So I don't think of it that way. I do absolutely love the idea of Juniper, you know, getting into carpentry or building if she wants to. I feel like it's a great pathway, particularly, you know, as so many workplaces now are being disrupted by AI and robotics, that trade-based, you know, skill sets are going to be so valuable that I think that you are going to see more people go into that space. I don't, maybe the answer is yes, and maybe I'm kind of looking beyond that now, but like right now, my immediate response is probably not.
Like if I say that I'm now more inclined than ever to give females a chance to work in our industry because I have a daughter, is that a bad thing to say?
No, I think both perspectives like resonate with me, and I feel like the pathway for anyone who doesn't occupy, you know, that sort of cis male background, I think if you can be open to employing anyone that results in diversity, I feel like any position you come from, I respect.
Can you explain the cis thing? I really struggle with this. Is that, if that's okay, like it's something that I really struggle to wrap my, like in the sense of like the definition of those sort of things.
Well, I guess in a sense, like the opposite to a cis male would be like, I guess, well, in terms of handy humans, we're women and genderqueer led. And genderqueer would, to put it simply, it's people who don't identify with the sex they were assigned at birth.
Yeah.
Obviously, in the construction industry, that is a minority. And the Handy Humans little collective are certainly representative of that.
And how many of you are there in your Handy Humans?
Within our business, there's three.
Yeah.
So it's myself, my pronouns, she, her, our painter, Lana, who's been a painter for maybe a decade as well, her pronouns, her, she, and then my partner, April, Native Garden Design. And April's pronouns are they, them.
And do you kind of all jump in with each other? So, for example, you'll jump in with the garden design and painting, and the painter jumps in with the carpentry, or it's like stay in your lane?
Matt, it's very organic, but we definitely give each other a hand. My project over the last couple of months, I've been working in with another chippy in his 60s, which I've absolutely adored, and we've been doing up a house in Candalo, and we've essentially just got the outside of that ready for our painter, Lana, who's going to be coming by in the next couple of weeks to get started on that house.
So for example, I'll use Lana as the example. Like, do you work day-to-day with Lana, or it's just part, like, it's part of the service? So like, I'll come and do the carpentry, now Lana will come in and do this part of it. Like a builder, like, but you're more in-house.
Yeah. And, you know, there was a conversation that I had with Lana in the lead up to establishing Handy Humans. And Lana's a one-person show and takes on some pretty big projects. And quite often she feels a little bit alone, even though she's working in with her respective trades on her jobs. But turning up to work every day and not feeling like you belong to a team can be quite a lonesome journey for her. And whilst we aren't in each other's pockets every single day, I feel like Lana being able to go to work and knowing that she's a part of the Handy Humans Collective kind of feels like she's got a little team around her. And yeah, we really value her within our little business of the Handy Humans. And it's, yeah, like I said, it's kind of a little bit organic at the moment in terms of how we would define ourselves, but we certainly consider ourselves like we are all on the same page in terms of our values and stuff.
And so I'm going to ask you a question now, and I mean, I actually don't know how to ask it, and I'm actually asking it out of curiosity and probably respect. So your pronouns are she, her. Mm-hmm. And then, did you say Lana is your painter?
Yeah.
And is her pronouns a her, she? Can I just understand that a little bit more? And I'm actually saying this because I want to be able to show up the best that I can when someone wants to be referred to as the pronouns that they want to be referred to. Could you just explain that for me so I've got a better understanding around that?
Do you mean in terms of the order that I shared it?
Order, yes.
No, that was just that was just. I don't think there's much of a difference.
Oh, yeah. I was like, sorry, that is a ripping question. I'm sitting here like, whoa, I've got no idea what the answer to that one is.
Because I wrote it down, and I was, you know, obviously I'm incredibly curious, right? And I hope that was a respectful question to Sal, because it was actually intended for me just to understand, and hopefully, you know, the audience to understand something like that. So. Okay, so maybe it was just the order that you said it, and it actually has no relevance. Okay, thank you.
No, but I appreciate you paying attention and tuning in. I feel like the pronoun, the world of the genderqueer is something that people don't really like tap into too much, because they feel like it should be assumed knowledge, or they don't want to make anyone feel uncomfortable. So, yeah, I appreciate that question, Hamish.
Is it okay to ask? It's like for someone like myself, or actually I'll even go a generation longer, that they've done something for a certain way or called someone a certain way for a certain period of time. And then that adaption to change, especially on a building site, like building sites are the worst place for change, let alone building better. And then now introducing that space of navigating and learning. Have you found any ways to like sort of educate those around you to embrace that more rather than just like rock up and be shy of asking questions?
I mean, I think like in the environments that we kind of occupy here within our friendship groups, you know, both kind of more hetero and genderqueer, it's pretty obvious to me in that initial kind of introduction period of people's pronouns, and they might just state it immediately, or you just might know of it anyway. But I think I mentor this young kid in the area, and their pronouns are they, them, and they want to get into the construction industry. And I talked to them a couple of weeks ago over a cuppa, and I was even cautious, even with my background and understanding of what it means to be queer in the construction industry. Obviously, I don't have the experience of being genderqueer necessarily, and, you know, I was quite careful with the way that I was sort of wording things with this particular person. And they were really quick to say to me that the teams that they've been hanging out with and in, they introduced themselves really early on. And one of the other chippies in his early 20s was like, hey, I've heard these are your pronouns, they, them. Like, and they literally had a discussion about it really early on. And this person that I'm mentoring was like, this is awesome. Like, I feel so seen. I feel so acknowledged. Now we can actually just get on and do good work, because that's what I'm here to do. This is what I'm here to learn. Like, yeah, that type of acceptance for them was huge. And it was just a matter of like recognizing it as if it was a, hey, how are you going? As opposed to like feeling like it needed to be this big secret that you couldn't, you know, kind of like explore.
And younger kids are better at this, I feel. I think the word you use, cautious, is really cool, because I think it's us being cautious. We're scared to not say the wrong thing or come at it from a wrong way. But most of the time it's coming from a good place, but it's like tiptoeing around on the eggshells, being like, oh, I don't want to offend anyone, but I'm really curious to know how I can actually make things easier for them.
Yeah, and I think in some ways the discomfort that you're trying to avoid is the discomfort that you need to sit in. And I think what you'll probably recognize through that, and even, you know, in how you've framed these questions, Matt and Hamish, like I feel like you would be more than capable of having these conversations. But I also feel like from the podcast that I've listened to over time with you two, I feel like you guys are pretty progressive in terms of understanding the nuances. But yeah, I would love to see the construction industry more broadly implement this type of, yeah.
Like just have rip these the Band-Aid off kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I think that is important. I mean, even, you know, yes, you're right. I feel like I would like to think that I'm reasonably progressive and open-minded when it comes to these topics, you know, particularly in the construction industry. And I must admit, even me asking the question before, I was very, I was being quite measured in how I was asking the questions because I didn't want to offend anyone. So what is some advice that you could give our audience and on how to ask that question, how to broach it? Because once the question's asked, it's then easy. Like this young 20-year-old who all of a sudden has had this, sounds like this really beautiful interaction with the person that you're mentoring, and now it's just normal. Like, because at the end of the day, it is just normal. Have you got some advice for someone who maybe wants to start that conversation?
I mean, I don't know how to respond without like complete and utter transparency. It could even be as simple as being like, "Hi, my name's Hamish. My pronouns are he, him." And then immediately by you stating your pronouns, which might be assumed by someone else, that creates a safe space or an opening for someone else to then like state theirs. Like even if it's all just assumed, like we have this little group of, you know, our walking football group every Sunday every fourth Sunday of every month we get together, and it's for women and genderqueer people. And if we have someone new, then we all stand around in a circle and introduce ourselves followed by our pronouns. And whilst that might sort of feel a little bit official, it basically just creates a safe space for everyone to, you know, have their opportunity to introduce themselves as to how they identify. And some of the older cohort of that particular group are a little bit awkward around it, and they don't kind of buy into the whole pronoun thing, which is fine, and you respect that as well. But at least you're giving someone the opportunity if they feel like they want to, in terms of that being a safe space.
Hey, I'm just thinking to our conversations with Julie when we're asked people about mental health and whether they're feeling all right. And Julie always made the comment, if someone's having a heart attack, would you ask them if they feel, are you okay? I feel like this is a bit of a, I don't know, maybe I'm a bit naive here. Is this very similar? You just ask.
Yeah, I do think so, Matt. Now I'm just thinking about, so my nannies that look after my kids and have done for a long time, they're in a queer relationship. And I have sat down and had some of the most amazing conversations with them because I've just asked the question, you know, and I did ask the question around pronouns before. And I actually don't know how to ask this, but just know that it's coming from the right place. And then that's kind of, it opened up an opportunity for me to ask a question because, you know, I've known these girls for 6 or 7 years now, and, you know, they're such an amazing part of my children's life. And I don't want to sort of sound like I'm virtue signaling here, but I actually think it's so beautiful that my kids actually see a same-sex relationship as just being normal. Whereas if I think back to when I was that age, like that shit wasn't normal. And I think that's great. But I think just asking the question and just having a, you know, going with hands open and saying, hey, I'm really curious and I want to respect you. So I'm going to maybe fumble through this question, but please help me as I potentially stumble through it I'm about to say. And it has been received really well from Sienna and Tia.
If it's going to be awkward for you, it might come across as awkward for them too, but also probably quite endearing and respectful.
You've also had some health challenges in your life as well. Are you happy to talk about that?
Yeah. Which direction are you going to go in, Hamish?
Well, aren't you a cancer survivor?
Yes, I have experienced cancer in a pretty, I mean, no cancer is enjoyable and no cancer is comparable, I suppose, in terms of each individual's experience. But yes, I was diagnosed with ovarian cancer and it was a pretty scary time. Where did you want me to begin with that?
This is your story, Sal. So you tell us.
So well into my carpentry journey, I guess, April and I got married and we were like, hey, let's have a kid. And I was definitely flying that flag more than April, and April was just kind of happy for me to entertain the idea of having and raising a child in my belly. And in 2020, we went for our IVF, kind of like I have a physical examination, and they found a weird growth on my right ovary, which they took care of, removed that right ovary. And because April and I were still in the IVF system, they said, look, it might be a chance of going into the other ovary, but we're just going to leave it be because at the moment you're cancer-free, but we know that you want to venture down the IVF path, so we'll just leave it at that and just keep monitoring your tumor markers. So a couple years passed and I was getting my tumor markers looked into every few months and they just kept on growing and growing and growing. And there was a little bit of neglect from the medical system, but also April and I had relocated and fallen out of the IVF process just because I think we're a bit rattled by what happened in 2020 in terms of my health. And we were just sort of still sitting in the space of, oh, do we want to have a kid? Don't we? Sort of just, yeah, mulling things over. And then the decision around me bearing a child was made pretty quickly for us in that we learnt that the cancer had spread not only into my other ovary but into my peritoneal layering, which was pretty devastating, and that's where it got really scary. But in a sense, super lucky when they picked it up, because without the IVF process, the cancer would have just kept on growing because I wasn't symptomatic. And that's what they kind of consider ovarian cancer. That's the sort of the silent killer. And by the time you learn about it, it's generally too late. So fast forward to 2023, I was in line for a pretty hectic operation. So it's called a peritonectomy. These surgeries go from anywhere from like 8 hours to 20 hours. And they unzip you from your sternum to the top of your pubic bone. And it's kind of an interesting operation in a sense, because you're completely open and they have to take out all of your organs from inside your abdomen to look around for cancer. So the peritoneal layer essentially is a layer of tissue that covers all of your organs inside your abdomen. So they scooped everything out and inspected it. And as you're unzipped, they send off tissues to be tested. And if it's cancerous, they remove said organs. So at the end of that operation, 10 hours later, you have your internal chemo just before they zip you back up. They took out my left ovary, my uterus, and something else that we don't need that we have removed sometimes when we're kids. What is that?
Appendix, gallbladder?
Yes, appendix, yes. So I'm sure we probably do need them, but in my case, that went as well. And then, yeah, so waking up from that surgery, learning about my uterus and ovary having to be removed, also recovering from that operation, having a year off work, all led to a pretty challenging time. And then, you know, that grief of not being able to have a kid biologically or however we were going to choose to then sort of set in as well.
Had you already known pre-surgery that that was the outcome?
I knew that there was a very high chance that they would take those things. And I guess I had to give the surgeon that permission to do that. But Matt, I was pretty sure that I didn't want to have like any risk of having cancer ongoing. And it felt like a really ruthless thing to do. And the decision to have a child obviously became very, very abrupt for me. But I would rather have made that decision than be risking, you know, the ongoing chance of having cancer moving forward.
I'm going to repeat what Hamish said at the start. When you said that you don't have much to share, I'm sitting here being like, I don't think I have actually sat in a podcast that has been this interesting yet.
I'm actually speechless. Like, I think, yeah, you know what? I think if we were in person right now, I'd just be leaning over and, you know, if it was okay, I'd give you a big hug and say, you know, how are you? So can I ask that, Sam? Like, how,
also
how
to
are
give
you
context,
now?
Like, Sal's camera's not working as well. And if you were to say that we're going to have a podcast with no camera, how are we going to read people's body language? Then you have someone coming on saying, I don't know if I've got much to share. Well, I think you've proved that one wrong.
I was actually watching you, Matt, during that story. And I think you and I were both just the same, just probably speechless. And thank you so much. I think that's going to be really powerful for a lot of people, you know, to hear that. And like, I'm actually in awe of hearing of your story from the age of six and everything that you've gone through, where everything's happened to you, positive, negative, like that builds the chapters in your life. And then, you know, to get to 2023 and hear about that surgery, you know, and then to have the honor of sitting here with you now in November of 2025 to actually have a conversation with you and hear about it. I actually don't know what to say, Sal. How are you now? Like, how are you now?
Well, thank you to you both for a start, because I feel very safe and comfortable in chatting and sharing these types of things. So kudos to you both. How am I now? Physically, I suppose, as a 36-year-old, like, surgical menopause was immediately kind of like an experience for me, which I think my body has taken a big hit. And given that I had the experience of elite sport, carpentry, and then the cancer, I feel like my body doesn't bounce back as quick, which I've had to ease back on several things, including my like full-time pursuits as a carpenter, where I was before I got my 2023 diagnosis, I was working 4 days a week full-time, or that I considered that full-time. And then since, I guess, in relation to carpentry, since coming back from that time off, my working weeks look very different. And in terms of like how I'm feeling now, I'm cancer-free. Every 6 months I'm tuning in with my oncologist, and the type of ovarian cancer I had is quite rare. They don't have much data on it. So they're still, whilst I'm like, you know, 2 or 3 years down the track, they're still very cautious and want to keep an eye on it, which I'm kind of grateful for, I guess. But yeah, every time those appointments roll around, it's always a bit unnerving. But the more those appointments pass, the more confident I become as well. But yeah, like I think like there's a really interesting part of that diagnosis that I think is worth sharing, given that this is somewhat of a building podcast, but I worked for a wonderful builder in this area. His name is Ben. And when I was originally diagnosed with that when I was finally diagnosed with the cancer in 2023, I was on site and I took a phone call off my oncologist, and talk about feeling like a woman on a job site. But we were all having smoko and everyone was sitting down, and I had this phone call and I was walking down this like gravel road and I heard this news. I'm going to get a bit emotional. I hung the phone up and my boss was just there. He could tell that I was incredibly upset, and he gave me the longest hug and I just couldn't believe the level of kind of love and support that I felt from him at that time. And I didn't really know what to do. I sat down with everyone and I'm like, everyone's just really polite and quiet and probably not know what to say. And then it was quite soon after I left, and I didn't go back for like over a year. Like, it was this really intense time, but I could just tell that I had this like huge amount of support from my boss at the time. And after I finished with him on that particular day, we kept in touch over the next sort of year and a half, and he kept in touch with me whilst I was in hospital and recovering, and, you know, more than just a boss, like as a friend. And I ended up picking up some work with him when I recovered from my operation and from that stint of cancer. But it became pretty apparent that, you know, the expectation of being on site at 7 a.m. until 4 p.m. 3 to 4 days a week was just going to be too much. And whilst I sort of like flagged with him the idea of, you know, maybe like shortening my hours here and there and coming onto site at 9 a.m., like for him at that time with his business and where it's at, that was not a plausible option. And I absolutely respected that. Like, we were having some pretty open conversations in and around his expectations around commitment. And which partly is what pushed me towards starting Handy Humans, in a sense. So I, in some ways, have him to thank for that too.
I just want to say thank you for sharing all of that, Sal. I think that's, you know, a pretty brave thing to come on and talk to a couple of guys who run a little podcast and tell that entire story.
Yeah, so speaking to two guys about this is probably...
I feel, as I said, I feel pretty honoured and feel very privileged to be able to, you know, sit here and listen to this.
So I've got a question for you. Are you on the tools full-time now?
No. So the way that my week looks now is that Monday till Wednesday, I'm working for my business, Handy Humans. So I'll either have my own projects, which are generally sort of small one-person gigs, or I'm working in with builders, I guess, as like a contractor. Then on Thursdays, I teach woodwork at a workshop in Bega, which is owned by my...
Cheese company?
Yes.
Is it actually?
Yeah. That's what Vega is notoriously known for. But no, I have this separate part-time job where, so Jo Sakamani, she is in her 60s. She's been a builder for the last three decades, and she for 10 years has run this workshop where she teaches women and kids woodwork. So I've obviously tuned in with her, and we have a surf club together. We build together, and we teach power tools and stuff too, every so often with different groups of women. And Friday's a little bit loosey-goosey. I'll either hang in the garden with April, or we finished our van set up, for example, yesterday afternoon just for our little adventure mobile. So that would probably be my working week in a nutshell, yes.
So for anyone that says women shouldn't be in a trade and the female body's not built for physical work, or women can't lift stuff on site, I kind of want to point them to this podcast, and I want you to point them to this podcast, because I think you prove that completely wrong. You've got a cooked knee, you've had an extremely invasive surgery, and yet you're still able to get out and do things. I think that is unreal.
And I think, thank you, Matt, that's kind to point out, but I do think that I'm carving a very unique pathway. Like, when I listen to your podcast, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on, you know, building technologies and moving forward. And I feel like possibly my comment to you in the original days, Hamish, was that I don't feel elite enough in the building world to be on this podcast more than anything.
So I'm sorry to interrupt for a second, Sal, but I have your story in my notepad here right now from the age of 6 to 38. And... yes, we have a big focus on building technologies and building better and all about that. But this is a story that people need to hear about resilience, about life throwing shit at you, about life being amazing to you. And every single time in your life, you've like, okay, great. Life, that's happened to me. I'm going to accept that, and I'm going to move on to this next chapter of my life. Because, you know, at the age of 25, when you got these knee injuries, your life could have been something completely different to what it is now. You could have been like other elite sports people who have just, you know, gone to depression, maybe turned to drugs, alcohol, and or, I don't know, done something else. But you've like, right, I'm going to do carpentry, and then I am going to start my own business because I can't fit into... I guess, what other people would consider normal work hours. Like, this is 100% a story that needs to be heard, and not just on a building podcast, but just about understanding resilience. Like, it's incredible.
Thank you.
You spoke about at the start about your younger soccer players, football players, whatever we're calling them, being bratty and saying that when you turn up to play football, we're here to play football.
Mm.
Is that the same with carpentry now when you find with the younger crew that you work with?
What do you mean? Like, that would be the way that I would encourage them?
To learn. Because, like, I think there's I think the hard thing is sometimes separating work and social. Like, coming to work isn't a social event. It can be at times. I'm just wondering how you brought that in, because you're probably dealing with younger kids, actually even younger than what we probably deal with on site.
Mm.
Am I thinking, it's actually one of two questions I've got written down here, which is, how you've tried to navigate that and use that experience to bring into your day-to-day carpentry.
Yeah, I mean, like, I guess my experience of late has been with, like, older sort of carpenters in their 60s, but I can definitely refer back to last year when I was working with Ben and had, like, a young kind of fella, I guess. His young apprentice was, you know, I spent a lot of time with him, and I think that there's a certain kindness that I'd like to think that would exist on site when he and I were hanging out, and I would encourage him towards, you know, asking as many questions as he possibly could, just trying to create an environment for him where he felt safe to make mistakes and to own up to mistakes if he made them, which I think is really important. And I wonder sometimes with apprentices if they just feel like they should know everything. So all of a sudden when they do make boo-boos or they don't quite understand something, they're not confident enough to ask. And I kind of feel like I wish I was in a team sometimes where I had more access to young people, because I feel like that has always been an interest of mine, encouraging people into an area where they, you know silly questions to be asked, and which is definitely my attitude as an athlete as well with the Sam Kerr and Caitlin Ford, et cetera. But, yeah, I think it's important to be able to create a safe space for people to know that, like, yeah, they don't have to know everything at any given time.
I think that's great. I actually think there's a really great message there for apprentices. I think they need to own the fact that they don't know everything and wear that as a badge of honour, because I certainly don't want, you know, a young apprentice thinking they know everything. Like, I want them to be hungry for knowing answers. Like, say, hey, I don't know this. Can you please explain it to me? So just own that fact.
At the start, and it kind of links back to everything we've sort of spoken about. At the start, you said as a soccer player, as you got older, the pressure grew. And with more experience, there was sort of more demand, but you learned to do more. Do you feel the same with carpentry now?
I guess that kind of ties into to the whole philosophy of continuing to learn. Like, I still feel like a young carpenter, and I'm hungry to learn. And I came across this quote. Well, I don't even know if it's a quote, but it's my approach. And as a carpenter, whilst, you know, I have to kind of keep my elite sports person at bay sometimes, like Hamish, you posted something about some work yesterday, and I'm like, oh, wish I lived in your area. I'd be up for that for sure. But in actual fact, like, I can't be saying I can't be throwing myself at carpentry the way that I want to be in terms of, like, answering to my elite athlete brain. But definitely within my context, within the path that I'm creating for myself as a carpenter, like, I want to be better tomorrow than what I am today. And as of today, I want to be better than what I was yesterday. And that's partly my growth mindset at the moment. So it's pretty contained. I don't have any grand plans with my career, but I basically just want to do good work and, yeah, be better tomorrow than what I am today.
I think if you don't achieve anything more in your career, you've already achieved enough, to be really honest with you.
Thanks, Matt.
I agree with that, but I also am so excited to be following Sal's career.
Yeah, I mean that in
life.
A good way.
I just want to say thank you so much for sharing your story, because it's been super interesting, and I think whatever part of this podcast that people tune, you know, decide to kind of really zone in on, I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned in a number of different parts of the of your story. So thank you so much for sharing that with us today.
Thanks for having me, you two. I really appreciate it.
And how do we get onto you? How do people reach out to you?
We don't have a website. It's pretty much just our Instagram, but we'd like to create some version of a newsletter moving forward. But at the moment, that's the only means, which has all our contact details and stuff. So it's just _handyhumans.
Thank you so much. Really excited that we connected. And also shout out to Brad from Sanford Buildco, because he's actually the person that pointed me to your Instagram page.
Yeah, really enjoy Brad. Got a lot of time for him.